a pulsing cosmic phenomenon, and how to deal with delays when you're supposed to be in space. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. About 15,000 light years away, something is sending out radio waves and X-ray signals every 44 minutes. Astronomers are now raising the question of what could this be? Is it something like a white dwarf star, or could it be a sign of life far away from our planet? We'll speak with Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's Terry Oswalt about this strange cosmic phenomenon. Then, Axiom Space's next commercial mission to the International Space Station, AX-4, was supposed to launch last week, but technical difficulties on the ground and a leak at the space station delayed the flight. So what's it like for an astronaut that's ready for launch, only to have their flight scrubbed? We'll speak with astronaut and Axiom 2 mission pilot John Schaffner about his flight to space and what's ahead for Axiom's fourth crewed mission to the ISS. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Every 44 minutes, something pulses deep in the galaxy. It could be a white dwarf star, or something like a pulsar, but this object doesn't quite fall into any of the categories of what we think this may be. For instance, the X-rays and radio pulses being emitted are stronger than any known pulsar. Because it's sending out such strong, timely signals, could this be a sign of intelligent life? Could an extraterrestrial civilization be sending out an SOS? Or is this something less science fiction-y? Well, here to answer these questions and talk about these strange signals and give us his thoughts is Terry Oswalt, Associate Dean and Professor at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Terry, I'm glad to have you back on because there is an unknown pulsing object in our universe that astronomers are starting to notice. When it comes to pulsing objects that we have no idea what to do with, I always come to you first. So what do we know about this object? Where is it? How far away is it?
Well, there are plenty of pulsating objects in the universe that we know about, but this one is unique at the moment. It's got the license plate number ASKAP, A-S-K-A-P, which is an acronym for the project. But this object turned up as a kind of a serendipitous discovery. Andy Wang at Curtin University in Australia, which is one of the participating universities in the International Center for Radio Astronomy Research, picked up an object that was emitting a pulse of radio signals that each pulse lasted about 2 minutes, but it was like clockwork, repeating every 44 minutes or so. And looking back at the record, it seems like this object started doing that something like a little less than a year ago. And there is some signs that the pulses are diminishing in the recent weeks. But this one's unique because, first of all, way brighter in radio wavelengths than we would expect for its distance of 15,000 light years. That's a quarter of the way across the galaxy from us. The thing that makes it unique and worthy of telling the astronomical community about in a kind of a bulletin fashion is that it was detected in X-rays. And so far, it's the only object known to be pulsating like this in both X-rays and radio waves. Radio waves don't take as much energy to generate as X-rays. So this thing is stupendously energetic if it's emitting both radio and X-ray pulses.
Now, let's go back because we have talked about pulsars on this program before. Just briefly describe what is going on with them. They are spinning and emitting these waves of energy, right? And that's how we kind of see this consistent blip when we look at it, right? Am I getting that correct?
Yeah. Back around the turn of the century, 1900 to 1920, it was realized that when a star like the sun runs out of fuel, it will eventually compress in on itself and become what's known as a white dwarf star. But in the 1930s, it was shown that if you make a star more than about 1.5 times the sun's mass, it can't stop compressing and become a white dwarf star. It will become what's known as a neutron star. Long story short, it's so compressed that the electrons and protons and neutrons are all crammed together and they become neutrons when you do that. So it's a gigantic ball of neutrons that's the size of a city. Think of that.
Wow. Well,
1 to 3 times the sun's solar mass and the size of Orlando. That's
terrifying.
It's terrifying when you think about it. But that's what a neutron star is. It's the dead hulk of a star that's more massive than the sun. So it can't stop compressing until the neutrons are all that form. Now, where's the pulsar come in? All neutron stars are not pulsars, but all pulsars are neutron stars. Put two hotspots on a neutron star. the magnetic poles are likely to be bright. And these objects are so hot, you can think of them as having a searchlight at the north and south magnetic poles. And like the Earth's magnetic field is not lined up with its rotation axis, neither are the typical magnetic fields of these neutron stars. So there's a beam of light and radiation being emitted at the north and south magnetic poles of a typical neutron star. As it rotates, most are spinning several dozen times a second. Even the slowest ones are spinning at several minutes per revolution. If you happen to be in the line of sight of one of those beams, the object brightens every time it rotates one time when the beam sweeps across your field of view. And so that's, you call it a pulsar. That's what Dr. Bell discovered back as a graduate student in the 1960s. These are mostly visible as pulses of radio waves coming from neutron stars whose beams of radiation happen to point in our direction. And now, that's a plausible explanation at face value for J1832-0911, except it doesn't work. This object is stupendously more powerful than any known pulsar, even though it does emit radio waves. They're 44 minutes apart. Most pulsars are rotating several times a second, and the slower they rotate, the less bright they are. The fact that this is a relatively slow rotator and really bright, not just in radio, but now also in X-ray, far exceeds anything known in the hundreds of pulsars that we know about so far. It's spectacularly more energetic despite a relatively slow rotation rate. In fact, it's something like these are very hard radio X-rays in the jargon of Chandra X-ray that was detected by the Chandra X-ray telescope just by accident back in February of 24 when Chandra was observing a supernova remnant that's nearby this particular object in the sky. It just showed up as a serendipitous bright spot in the X-ray images that corresponded to the radio signature that it was given. So anyway, it's probably not a pulsar. It's way too energetic and rotating too slow for rotation to be powering the beam that we recognize as the pulses in radio. And who knows how the X-rays are being generated.
Let's just recap real quick about all of the strangeness and quirkiness of this, right? So it's pulsing at a far less frequent time frame. It is very, very strong in both radio and X-rays. It just started doing this.
Well, we could have done this many years before. We just had noticed it started about a year ago.
Okay. So we're able to make these observations. Is there, and I know that this we're starting to get ourselves into speculation here, Terry, but what could this possibly be if it's not a pulsar?
One of the priority explanations is that it might be a magnetar. And now, what's a magnetar?
That sounds cool. It sounds like
a combination of magnetic and star, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, if you make a star, a neutron star, that's perilously close to three solar masses, you make it bigger than that, it'll become a black hole because it'll compress and collapse. If you combine two white dwarf stars or you have a really massive star remnant that just butts up against the maximum mass for a neutron star, and you start with a star that had a strong magnetic field, you end up with what's called a magnetar. There are a few dozen known. They're rare because, you know, very massive stars are quite rare, and stars with strong magnetic fields are quite rare too. And they are stupendously massive compared to, say, the Earth or the Sun. And they do rotate. You can think of them as neutron stars on steroids. But the problem is the radio luminosity is 10,000 times brighter than any known similar magnetar. And so this is an outlier, even in the esoteric regime of magnetars. There's a second possible explanation that doesn't seem to fit either. And that is, well, you can have a garden variety star like the Sun, or even a little less massive, in a very close orbit around a white dwarf or neutron star. And that orbital interaction through tides and maybe even exchanging masses can drive pulses that are related to the orbital rate or the rate at which matter is regularly dripping onto the companion star. But if you do that, if you make the calculations, you find that that explanation doesn't work either, because such objects binary stars that have a compressed object like a white dwarf or neutron star with a companion star don't tend to emit X-rays that are so energetic. And the radio wavelengths, the pulses that they emit, are about 100 million times less bright than what we're seeing. So all of the coolest, most exotic explanations that have been advanced so far have problems. They don't explain this one-of-a-kind object. Now, I use the word one-of-a-kind, but in science in general, if you find one object of a particular kind, chances are you're going to find others. So stay tuned. You'll probably hear in the news, you know, in coming months, something else, some others have been discovered. Just give you one last analogy. You've got a credit card, right? You don't put that credit card anywhere close to a magnetic field, for the simple reason that it'll wipe out the magnetic stripe. A magnetar, and this object in particular, a super duper version of what might be a magnetar, will wipe out all your credit cards from roughly the distance of the moon.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The X-rays will kill you first.
But. Okay. Well, yeah. We don't have to worry about our credit cards not swiping. So, Terry, I know we were in the realm of speculation. We were dipping our toes into that. I'm going to take us into a dive into the deep end of science fiction. Could this possibly be some sort of civilization trying to get our attention? Is this an intergalactic beacon? Because it does seem absolutely strange and it doesn't fit in any of these categories. Could we think wildly out of the box and this is some other civilization that's trying to get our attention?
Well, if that's the case, they are in control of energy levels that are trillions of times higher than anything humans have been able to control.
So that would be terrifying.
Would be terrifying.
Okay. Yeah.
But now, and just to put things in perspective, you may recall when Jocelyn Bell discovered the first pulsar back in the 60s, it was labeled LGM-1. You remember what LGM stood for?
No.
Little Green Men.
Oh.
As the pulses were thought initially to be so regular that they might have been intelligent.
Well, I'm glad I'm thinking. I've got decades old thinking when it comes to these kinds of things. So, okay, so it's terrifying that we think that. So I'm going to take us out of the deep end, bring us back into the shallow end here, Terry. And as you mentioned, these astronomers, these researchers have published these findings because this is how science works. You publish these findings and now other people are trying to figure out what this is. What happens next? Will we get an answer? And how does the science community at large help these original researchers figure out what they found?
Well, I mean, it's a good example of how science works. We work with hypotheses, which are a scientific way of saying the best educated explanation or educated guess, if you will. But each one of those possible explanations, like a souped up version of a pulsar or a magnetar or a binary system that are interacting, each one of those hypotheses have consequences or predictions that if this is the explanation, certain things must be observable or mathematically provable. So that's where we are in this particular project, is three hypotheses, two primary hypotheses have been proposed. And now the next step is to get more observations and have theorists work on mathematical models. The models that exist could be adapted to explain some of the peculiarities. So, you know, when you see scientists making changes in their explanation, you're seeing science being done. That's how it works.
Well, I cannot wait to see what science uncovers when it comes to this discovery. Terry Oswalt, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Anytime.
That was Terry Oswalt, an astronomer and associate dean and professor at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. Still to come, dealing with delayed flights to space.
As an astronaut, we were in our crew. You know, we were never concerned of any concern for ourselves. It was just we wanted to go. We wanted them to get it fixed and get it ready for us to hop on board.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. What's going on in the skies? From the summer solstice to meteor showers, there's a lot going on in the world of astronomy this summer. and some of it can be seen right in your backyard. A glimpse at the constellations and exciting astronomy. That's next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about Axiom Space's next commercial mission to the International Space Station. The company's fourth human spaceflight will fly on SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsule atop a Falcon 9 rocket. But during the initial planned launch, weather conditions and the discovery of a leak in the Falcon 9 booster delayed the mission. Plus, another leak was discovered, but this time it was on the International Space Station. Now, Axiom, SpaceX, and NASA are targeting a new launch window. The crew remains on the ground. So, what's it like to prepare for a journey into space, and what happens when the mission gets called off? Well, here to answer those questions and talk about this upcoming mission is John Schaffner. He's an astronaut. He was the pilot on Axiom 2 mission, a mission that also was delayed. John, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Brendan. It's always good to have a chat with you, and I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing great. We have to mention that you are here on the ground because you have joined us on this podcast from orbit, but not today, unfortunately, right?
Well, my favorite place to talk to you is probably, yes, from orbit. Not today. Maybe next time.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, John, that's a great segue into why we had you on the show today. You are a member of the AX2 crew. We've been anxiously anticipating the launch of Axiom 4, but that mission has been delayed. That's something you know quite a bit about, right? AX2 was delayed a bit, too. Tell us a bit about your journey and why it took so long for you to get into orbit, for us to have that conversation.
Well, we had a small delay. There was, I recall, SpaceX had the Falcon Heavy on our launch pad, 39A, and they had some delays in getting that booster off the ground, just some of their own things. It's, you know, rockets are pretty complicated things. So there was a delay there. Then they had to turn the pad around, change it from a Falcon Heavy launch configuration to support a Falcon 9 launch. And that takes about 3 weeks. So this, you know, the day or two tolerance that they have in doing those things caused us to miss our original launch date by 3 or 4 days. So nothing big. You know, we expect that in spaceflight, but eventually we made it.
Did you get a chance to watch that Falcon Heavy launch? Was it at least worth the wait?
Falcon Heavies are always pretty awesome to watch. Yes. Yeah, we watched it with anticipation because we needed it out of our way. We needed it to go do its job, right?
You know, ahead of the mission, the AX4 crew was in quarantine. You were as well. Tell us a bit about what it's like in those days leading up to launch. How close to your launch time do you come down here to Florida? What is that quarantine like? What are you doing while you're waiting to leave the planet?
Well, quarantine, you know, it's been a space traveler's enigma for a long time. It's something that's necessary to go to orbit, particularly the station. Even in the days of Apollo or Gemini, they did that because they wanted to launch a healthy crew. You don't want the crew, one member of the crew being sick and making the other crew member sick. And it's still true, and especially true now for the space station. There is a permanent crew of international partners in orbit, and you don't want to launch someone with even a head cold into orbit and infect the crew. And there's science and other things going on that you don't want stray microbes more than necessary. So they take 2 weeks of isolation, and it's also the final great bonding time for the crew, and the crew gets good solid time together to do some last fitness checks for themselves and also confirm the work schedule, the timeline, as it's called, you know, what they're doing and practice all of that and look to any final changes. So it's a great time for the crew to focus together as they ramp up their last tempo before launch.
How often are you getting updates about your mission? You know, I know the AX4 crew, their initial launch window was delayed because of weather and now a hardware issue on the ground and now a hardware issue in space. How often are you getting those briefings? I would assume more frequently than someone like myself is, right?
Yes, the crew, because their lives at risk and they are the ones that are ultimately responsible for conducting a good mission, you know, for their performance. They're highly involved in the loop, both from the NASA side because of anything relevant to the station, and more particularly from SpaceX. They provide daily updates on the health of the vehicle, the status of the preparation, the final stages of getting their flight capsule, their Dragon, mounted to the Falcon 9, and then its preparation for pad rollout. So the crew gets sometimes twice a day, and then as it gets closer to launch, they start getting daily weather briefs, looking forward to their weather window.
This AX4 mission was delayed after that weather delay due to a hardware issue with the Falcon 9 booster that was discovered during a hot fire test. Now NASA is saying there's a leak at the ISS that's causing additional delays as an astronaut who is about to fly on a mission on a booster like a Falcon 9 to the International Space Station. What would you be thinking about those delays? Are those terrifying to hear that your booster's leaking liquid oxygen? Or are you confident in the way that SpaceX handles fault trees and identifying the cause of that?
Well, the short answer is absolutely yes. Very confident. And of course, in SpaceX's understanding of their hardware, they design it, they build it, and things like leaks or small changes in the vehicle are expected. You know, these are dynamic pieces of equipment and these have been reused. So not a challenge to SpaceX to fix it. It's when they come up late in the stage of launch preparation, then of course they need proper time to be sure they understand it first and then institute the correct fix. And as an astronaut, we were in our crew, you know, we were never concerned of any concern for ourselves. It was just we wanted to go. We wanted them to get it fixed and get it ready for us to hop on board. So our terror, I guess, is more based on that we might not get to go than any concern for safety, I think, sometimes.
What advice would you give to the AX4 crew now as they are awaiting that time to launch?
Well, it's far be it for me to give anyone advice for that. I think they have a good, solid commander who's giving them good advice. You know, Peggy's been through this routine much often before. She coached us. You know, the thing that you expect in spaceflight more than anything is change. And that's the one constant in spaceflight, changing the schedule, change in what the expectations are. So for the crew, I think they have been preparing long enough that they certainly understand that changes in the schedule, even for an entire week, you know, if might be the case now, while certain things become more clear for them. It's unfortunate, but it's part of the realm of spaceflight.
You mentioned Peggy Whitson, who's the commander of this mission, was also the commander on your mission. Can you just briefly describe what kind of a leader she is, what kind of a crewmate she is to have?
Well, she's awesome in both roles, both as a crewmate and as a leader. We grew to, ultimately completely enjoy our time with Peggy. We learned from her each day we were with her. And she gave us, a solid basis and confidence. She was good at boosting our morale and supporting us as we were learning. And we knew from her experience that anything you do in space is going to be a new experience, and we should be open to experience and to enjoy that. She coached us, very well. And going to space is a challenging thing. It put trust and faith in the engineers and the team, the ground controllers, NASA, Axiom as an organization. We are completely, happy in our confidence to work with Peggy and take her guidance.
You know, when we spoke about your mission, your mission was the second of these commercially backed missions by Axiom Space. We're looking at the fourth mission now. We are moving further into this this chapter of the new space economy. In the 2 years since you flew on Axiom 2, what has been your big observation with the momentum that commercial space is having?
Well, you see it, I think we see it mainly in the ultimate launch cadence that you see companies like SpaceX continuing to ramp up their commercial activities for either satellites or payloads or other interests going to space, to and from space. That shows us that the activity in space on a commercial level is beginning to evolve quite nicely. The human aspect of that, of course, the ISS is the current, other than the Chinese, the sole human-based platform for now. And we're using that to continue to learn. And as NASA continues its progress toward taking us to the moon in several different forms, then we just see that growing in momentum, growing in reality, and then we look forward to rotating to Mars, focusing on our efforts to get to Mars at some point. But it's all learning, but I'm enjoying watching the stages of the evolution of how we learn, develop many of the activities that are taking place today.
Mm-hmm. So very few people have made it to orbit, and even fewer people in a position like yourself, at the forefront of commercial space development. How do you view your role, John, in this development? What is your place in it, and what has your contribution been?
Well, since coming back from space, it was, and as you said, there are a few people comparatively that have actually experienced spaceflight and what the Earth looks like and many of the things that will have an impression on you. My role, like many people have chosen to do, is to focus on outreach to education and letting young students understand that they have a role, future role in space at some point. It's there, whether it's in a career of engineering or technical support or communications about space or even actually going to space. I've always said that when I'm in a room of fourth graders, you see a room of 10-year-olds, likely out there in that group are future Martian astronauts. And I really, really like thinking that. It means that words that I might be able to provide them might encourage them to understand what they can do to advance, you know, humankind and our understanding of space and how we can move ourselves into the cosmos and do something valuable with that.
I know that was very important to you during your mission as well on AX2. And when we hear from the crew of AX4, that is also part of the things that they are excited to do while they're in orbit, is to do these outreach programs. I feel like you've already answered this question, but how important is it to continue to keep doing those things and getting these youngsters so involved in all sorts of aspects of space exploration?
Well, space and space exploration is not broadly taught in schools. That's why roles like that any astronaut on return, you know, can obviously fill, is being a teacher. Being a teacher even at a distance by providing materials or igniting conversations, joining classroom conversations at schools or in other ways, organizations or conferences, to help people understand the conversation of what it is that we're trying to do in space and what the opportunities are. So I don't think there is, Brendan, a point where you can expect to end doing that as an individual. Once you've had that experience, I think it's incumbent on us to use that and to share that with others in any way we can.
And finally, John, what's next for you? Are you leaving the planet once again?
Well, I sure hope so. I would, if it were up to me, I would have not come back from Earthland. yes, I do. I think there's a future trip for me at some point. I would love to see some additional platforms get in orbit. I'd like to see Axiom get a module up there and see and be able to go and test and experience the new experiences that platforms can develop. I support education in several ways and research on Earth targeted to space. So I constantly look for new ways to share what I've learned and to put that to use here on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope you'll make a few minutes while you're up there to chat with us once again. John Schaffner is an astronaut and was the pilot on the Axiom 2 mission. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Brendan, always a pleasure. Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the Central Florida Public Media app, NPR's app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, really wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay connected with this show on social media or on Instagram and Facebook. Our handle is at @AWTYSpace. If you got an idea for a future episode of the show or you want to join us as a guest, well, reach out to us. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org or space coverage online, cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Ashley Reap. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.